Making of Modern Judaism, number 11. Okay, we're continuing, moving through from the 1500s into the 1600s with one of the very, very influential Rabbanim in history, an individual by the name of Rav Yishayahu Horowitz ben Avraham, who is fondly known in Jewish circles as the Shla HaKadosh. Shla stands for his dominant sefer, and we'll get to some of the history as to how it got written, but his dominant sefer, which was the Shnei Luchos HaBris, the two tablets of the covenant, and he's one of three people who are referred to consistently as the Holy One. The other two are the Or HaChaim, the commentary on the Chumash, who we have not gotten up to yet, and the Ari, Rav Yitzhak Luria, also referred to as HaKadosh, who we have done. Interestingly enough, all of them were Kabbalists, hence that's how they earned their name, as HaKadosh, as the Holy. The Shla, where he's born, is unclear, although the going theory is that it was Prague, although some of the modern research, I should say, is suggesting more and more that he might have been born in Lemberg. We know for sure where he dies, because if you ever go on the great tzaddik burial tours in Israel, one of the great places they will take you is to Tveria, to Eretz Yisrael, to the north of Israel, where right near where the Rambam is buried, or is believed to be buried, that is where the Shla HaKadosh is buried as well. There's a lot of legend and lore that goes along with him, but we'll try to focus on some of the facts of his history, and then we'll learn also a little bit of his Torah. I figured we'd pick a little bit of it on this week's Parsha and on Hanukkah in general, which he merges or he conflates the two together. So number one is we know who his father was, the author of the Emek Bracha, which was a significant halachic work of the time. So he was born into a family of a Talmidei Chachamim, and also like many of the people that we've been learning about, many of the Jewish leaders of the time, he was also independently wealthy. Again, a lot of it had to do with the access that you could have to education. The more money you had, the more likely you were to be able to educate yourselves. And remember, we're dealing in a time when Jews were fairly successful. The Polish government was very interested in having them there, and there were opportunities for Jews to be successful, and many of them took advantage of those opportunities. But also, interestingly enough, is you can see here that his teachers were Rav Yehoshua Falk Katz and the Maharam of Lublin. Rav Yehoshua Falk Katz, we know, was the Prisha, and Maharam of Lublin, we know, was the rabbi in Lemberg for a few years. And we also, when we learned about the Maharam of Lublin, we also learned about the fact that that ultimately he had to leave Lemberg because of a great controversy. Standing on the other side of the controversy with the Maharam Lublin was Rav Yehoshua Falk Katz, which leads to the very interesting issue of was the Shla learning by both of them at the same time, or was he learning by one at a time? What's even more fascinating is the Shla will gain prominence not as a halachist, but as a Kabbalist, and that being said, his two most prominent influences were two of the great halachists of their time. The Maharam Lublin, remember we discussed his the importance of his responsa in medieval or late medieval Poland, and certainly the Prisha, who prided himself on his halachic decisions and his commentaries that he wrote on the Tur and on the Shulchan Aruch. So we know also that he gained prominence fairly quickly. How do we know this? Because again, we spoke about how the Council of the Four Lands had some very, very specific notes taken on their decisions. And in one of the enactments of the Council of Four Lands, lo and behold, In 1590, we find the signature of Rav Yishayahu Horowitz. Why is this important? So if you count up, if he's born in 1560, in 1590, he's all of 30 years old, and already he's signing documents of one of the most authoritative organizations, if not the most authoritative Jewish organization of the time. Okay, so that is kind of one. So we already know that he really takes his place as a leader and as a halachic force and as a Jewish leader in those times. He seems to be serving as an educator, as a learner, as a teacher, as someone who serves on the Batei Din, on the rabbinical courts in Lemberg for a while, until in 1606 he's named rabbi of Frankfurt am Main. This is a very, very big move. Why? Because remember, he is spending his time, even though he was perhaps born in Prague, the lion's share of his life to this point has been spent not in Western Europe, but in Eastern Europe, in the Polish communities. Frankfurt am Main is a much older community. It's a community that goes back all the way to probably the 10th century or 9th century even. It's one of the older communities amongst Jews. It's one of the last communities left in Western Europe after all of the expulsions. But it's also a fairly significant community. There's about 1,400 people living there, which in those days, that was a fairly large community. There weren't that many people on earth, let alone Jews, in that time. So for him to take over that community was a fairly significant act. And he leads that community, from what we understand, very, very capably. Problem is, as we said, whereas you had at least in the earliest part of the 1600s, a fairly sure sense of protection and safety in Eastern Europe, in Poland in particular, in the four lands, in Poland, in Ukraine, in Lower Poland, and in Russia, in those areas, you had a fairly safe existence. In Western Europe, your existence was much more tentative. Jews had already been expelled from Spain, certainly, but from Germany they had been expelled, from France they had been expelled, from England they had been expelled. Basically, it had become par for the course. For whatever reasons, having to do, as always, with economics, the leaders of the German communities around Frankfurt were very interested in the Jews staying. They weren't so much under the influence of the Pope, and therefore they had a little bit more freedom in terms of keeping the Jews. That being said, there are the winds of the time, the spirit of the time, or the spirit of the age, as you would call it. And the spirit of the age was one that was antagonistic towards Jews, particularly in Western Europe. And that antagonism will, of course, build, and particularly at times of economic struggle. And so in 1614, you have what I found out today, so it couldn't have been that famous, but the famous Fetmilk Uprising. The Fetmilk Uprising are where the guilds in Frankfurt rose up against foreigners. Foreigners is the code word for Jews, because how many foreigners are you going to find in Frankfurt in those times? But these guilds, who were feeling as if they were underprivileged and mistreated, they chased out all the foreigners. All of the Jews in the town lost all their property and all of their wealth. And they were basically permitted to leave. I think it was 1,380 Jews or something like that were permitted to leave with the shirts on their backs. We don't call this a pogrom because pogroms are officially invented in 1648 and 1649 with the Khmelnytsky raids. So this is not a pogrom, but it sure looks like a pogrom. They kick all of the Jews out of the town fairly successfully, and Rabbi Yishayahu Horowitz is left as a rabbi without a shteller. Interestingly enough, the leaders of Germany were the ones who responded harshly to the Fet Milk uprising and insisted that the Jews be returned. And in 1616, on the 19th of Adar, which became actually a holiday for the Jews of the of that area, they wouldn't say Tachnun. It was a big day. It's recorded in the communal documents. That's what they did. So the 19th of Adar in 1616 became a day in which they celebrated. But for Rav Yishayahu Horowitz, this was too much time to be waiting. You can't be 2 years out of a job and out of a shteller, and he did not wait around for that. He goes back to Lemberg before in 1619 he's made the co-rabbi in Prague. Again, this is my hunch, though I cannot prove it. It's my hunch is this is where he picks up some of kind of the mystical experience that ultimately becomes a part of the lore of the Shlach HaKadosh. That's because his teachers in Lemberg, Rav Yehoshua Fall Katz and the Maram Lublin, they are first and foremost halachists. They are not going to be the ones who are infusing him with mysticism. So too, you're not going to find mysticism in Germany, I can tell you that. But for the first time, he's coming into very much on the heels of the Maharal, who has just passed away a short time ago, but Prague was probably very much infused with some of that mystical thought. And if you remember what we said about the Maharal, is that the Maharal, even though he never says that he's quoting a Zohar or he's being inspired by some sort of mystical thought, there is a sense that a lot of the ideas and statements of the Zohar are very much behind what he's saying. So if he's creating a Beit Midrash, if he's creating a house of study with mysticism as part of it, and into this waltzes Rav Yishayahu Horowitz, an individual of great capacity and brilliance, one would expect that he would be someone who would go into further research in this area. And that's what I think happened. It's probably in Prague you begin this kind of inspiration. He's not in Prague for very long. Part of this has to do with the fact that his wife passes away. From what his son, Rav Shechtel Horowitz, writes about him, it seems that he was extraordinarily broken by his wife's passing. So much so, it seems that he was looking for a drastic change in his life. A drastic change which he didn't tell anyone about until the very, very last moments. And that drastic change was his decision that he was going to move to the land of Israel. That was his hope, was to move to the land of Israel. The community in Israel at the time is small but significant. You have, of course, the community in Safed, the great Kabbalists of the time, of course, Rav Yosef Karo, the Ari, Rav Yitzhak Luria, but this is after they have passed, but the torch has been passed to a newer generation of Kabbalists who are producing a good deal of mystical thought, and he is probably reading this, but interestingly enough, Rav Yishayahu Horowitz was not interested in going to Safed, but he was interested in going to Jerusalem. That was his desire. So in 1621, he basically surprises everyone, and I think a few days before he was going, he tells everyone, guess what, I'm making Aliyah. This was heartbreaking and heart-wrenching to his friends and family. They did not want him to leave. And so much so that they insisted that he write for them some sort of last will and testament, since this was really the last time they were going to see him, but something that they could take with him, his thought and his inspiration forever and ever. And so he agrees to write one of these things, and this is how the Shnei Luchos HaBris came to be written. This is how his magnum opus came to be written. And what his son, Rav Shechtel, says is that at the beginning, the work was intended to be a brief work that had kind of introductions and the Rosh Prakim, kind of the overall overviews of various issues in Jewish mysticism and his thought. But it became far more intricate than he realized when he began writing. So much so is that even after he moved to Israel, he continued working on the Sefer and only sent it to them after, when he finished it in Jerusalem, after also getting a hold of much of the works of the great Kabbalist, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. And so he makes it to Israel in 1621, and in that year, with great fanfare, he is made the official rabbi of the Ashkenazi community in Jerusalem. It is a small and exceptionally poor community as well. There were not many opportunities for making money. You were ruled as a vassal state of the Ottoman Empire, and you lived at the will and whim of the Sultan. So it wasn't great living of the time. And for someone with the means and the wealth of Rabbi Yishayahu Horowitz, so not only was he a leader in terms of spirituality and religion, in terms of the sermons he would give and the halachic guidance that he would offer, but also there's a number of records of Rabbi Yishayahu Horowitz giving great and immense loans to the Jewish community in Jerusalem for them to be able to handle some of the basic needs, because there was no one to collect taxes from. People didn't have any money. What's interesting is that this community kind of subsists for a brief period of time until 1625. When the Ottomans get wind of, and this seems to be a totally monetary move, the Ottomans get wind of the fact that there seems to be some money flowing within the Jewish community in Jerusalem, and he, along with four other leaders of the community, are jailed in 1625. The community comes together, raises an extraordinary large sum of money in order to ransom him, but also that seems to be very much the end of an organized community in Jerusalem in 1625. And what happens is, with the encouragement of the Shlah, the vast majority of the community begins a trek north, feeling that they will be safer out of the reach of the Ottomans in the northern areas past Tzfat, all the way up north to Tiberias, to Tveria. And that's ultimately where, in 1630, the Shlah dies right near the Rambam. Where he's buried right near the Rambam, to this very day. You can go to his grave. What are his publications? His publications, we said, was the Shnei Luchos HaBris, the Shlah, which is his magnum opus, a work of Jewish mysticism in very much the classical sense, and we'll get into it a little bit. The Toldos HaAdam, which is more of an ethical work, which is usually published as an introduction to the Shlah that was written later. He also wrote a Siddur, and in the introduction, I'm not sure if it is him or the person who was charged with publishing the book, but he makes the comment of the reason that he is writing a Siddur or a commentary on the Siddur is because he feels like one of the great legacies of his life will be the opportunity to touch on the tfilos, the prayers of each and every Jew for generations. So he thought that that was a real great opportunity. And also a halachic work, the Big Day Yesha, which is a commentary on the Mordechai on Moed. And that was also a book which was a bit obscure. So why is the Shlah important? So number one is the popularization of Kabbalah in Ashkenaz. Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, was for generations very much the property of the Sephardic community, who are the great popularizers until this moment of Kabbalah. So let's look at them. Let's look at them in order. So we start with the first great popularizer of Jewish mysticism, Nachmanides, followed by Rabbi Yosef ibn Jekatila, Rav Moshe de Leon, and then if you go into later generations, more contemporary to or close contemporary to Rav Yishayahu Horowitz, you have Rav Yitzhak Luria, the Ari, you have Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, and the Safed mystics. And so you have very, very few Ashkenazim who are embracing mystical study. That's why originally I was discussing with the Jewish history teacher the title of my class. So I said I wanted to title the class "The First Kabbalist of Poland," which she said to me, "Well, he wasn't the first Kabbalist of Poland." But from my perspective, I said, but from a religious historical perspective, or from an intellectual perspective, he really was the first Kabbalist of Poland. Because even though the Maharal might be learning Kabbalah, the Maharal is not inspiring others to learn Kabbalah. And even though there might have been some numerous Kabbalists in Poland who are studying these works, none of them are doing what the Shla, that work in particular, does to inspire the learning of Kabbalah within Ashkenazi communities. Why is this so important? Because the Shla's popularization of Kabbalah is going to lead into the learning of Kabbalah among some of the great Jewish leaders later on. Who are those leaders that are going to be learning or infused with the Shla? So number one, Shabtai Tzvi. Right? Shabtai Tzvi, very much in terms of the movement, or in terms of one of the philosophies behind his movement, his messianic movement, and its colossal failure, was very much a study of Kabbalah, a study of Jewish mysticism. Also, the Baal Shem Tov, the Maggid of Mezrich, Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, are steeped in the Shla. Chassidus. So Chassidism, one of the great debates about Chassidism is in terms of what is its spiritual forebear. Obviously, the Vilna Gaon, the contemporary of the Baal Shem Tov, believed that the spiritual forebear of Chassidism was none other than Shabtai Tzvi, and which is why he rejected it so vociferously. Going along with the Vilna Gaon's perspective is also none other than Gershon Shalom, the great historian of Jewish mysticism. He also says that Shabtai Tzvi is the forebear of Jewish mysticism. He believes that because there is an antinomian, right, a rejection or a transcending of the literal letter of the law tendency in both a Sabbatian movement and in the Hasidus movement, right? The Sabbatians believe that you could transcend halacha in terms of Avera Lishma, and there are those senses within Hasidus as well. You could daven Shachris until, you know, whenever the Spirit takes you. You can daven Mincha till 11 p.m. at night, because after all, it's all about the feeling, etc. That being said, Rabbi Lam, in his book on Hasidism, as well as others, have made the claim that the Shla might have been the real source of a lot of Hasidic thought. And you see it throughout Hasidic thought, that there are tendencies towards the Shla. And what's amazing is you could open up a Shla and you could read it on any parsha, and you could imagine it just as easily having been written by some Hasidic Rebbe. That's because, listen, Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, you know, the great founder of Lubavitcher Hasidus, is unashamed of saying that he believes in the Shla as one of the great thinkers, and he calls him one of his great influences. So that being said, so the Shla is far more powerful than we realize. So just to give you an example of where it might come up. So there's the famous pasuk in Parsha Struma, Vasuli Mikdash Veshachanti Bisocham. You should make for me a temple, and I will dwell in them. So there, the Shla makes the comment that each and every Jew has a Mishkan inside of him, and God will dwell therein, inside of that Mishkan. This sounds kind of like the sparks of holiness that are in every Jew that one might find in some Hasidic thought as well. So the Shla is no slouch in terms of his influence. And again, we don't often think about it. And also, to a certain extent, the Shla is a sefer which is written for scholars. And one of the things Chassidus was able to do quite successfully is break down some of these scholarly and intellectual thoughts of mysticism and break them out down into smaller parts for people to be able, for the, you know, the common Jew to be able to understand. So you don't, so less and less people were reading the Shlub because they were getting it in terms of trickle down Torah through a lot of the Hasidic rabbis, whether it be Rosh Neir Zalman, whether it be the Noam Elimelech, whether it be later on in terms of the Sfas Emes and others who are very much steeped in the Shlaz Torah. So I thought to bring the Shla on Parshas. He doesn't have, it's sort of interesting, I went to look up the Shla on Parshas Vayeshev. He doesn't have one commentary on Vayeshev, but he has on Vayeshev, Miketz, and Vayigash. We all know that Vayeshev, Miketz, and Vayigash are inherently intertwined because they are all dominated by one singular story, and that is the story of the relationship of Yosef and his brothers. The Shla says this is by no chance, he points out, that this story always shows up, that these parshios always show up around Hanukkah time. The reason that this story always, says the Shla, is because on Hanukkah is the day when Jews face the responsibilities of Achdus, of bringing people together. We all know that the experience of Hanukkah was not in fact the victory of the Jews over the Greeks, but it was in fact the victory of Jews over other Jews, and the sense of Achdus very much permeates the entire experience. So what does he say here? He says here as follows. He says, "Da ki kol Yisrael him nikraim nefesh achat." He says, "Know for sure that all of Israel is referred to as one soul. V'kulam nikraim adam, and every one of them is called a person." Right? The entirety of the Jewish nation is a person. Kemoshe Neamar Adam Atem, as God says to Ezekiel, you are a human being. Classic Kabbalistic or mystical interpretation that basically takes a pasuk out of context, will take two words and build a philosophy out of it. And so too it'll say in Bereishis Memvav, which is actually Parshas Vayichi, Kol HaNefesh HaBa'al Yaakov. The entirety of the soul that came from Yaakov. And here, so the Shla is going to make a big deal of this. He says, because all of Israel is one soul, right? We are all parts of one singular soul. And just as one body has Ramach Evarim, one body has Ramach, Resh, Mem, Ches, right? Resh is 248 pieces. So too, the Jewish soul, the singular Jewish soul, also has 248 pieces, and each one of them makes up the whole, and each one of them is significant. And he says, "Listen." Also, he says, well, "Some of them are the brain, some of them are the heart, some of them are the eye, some of them are the hand, but all of them are significant and all of them need to be working in concert in order to be successful." Again, you can find echoes of this in Chassidus, in the notion of the importance of not only, you know, the scholars and the Talmidei Chachamim, but, you know, every, you know, single Jew playing his role in that issue. In the notion of creating the singular Jewish soul. He also points out, again, in typical Kabbalistic style, that this world reflects or carries the spherotic realm of the next world. So he says, Heim Merkava Lesod Adam Hayoshev Ala Kisei. They are the Merkava, they are the chariot that carries the Adam, the human that stands upon, that sits upon the great, or the depiction of humanity that stands upon the great throne of heaven. So what is that referring to? We pointed out that the spherotic realm is also built of of 10 different, it's built in the model of a human being. So Am Yisrael, in its unity, so too corresponds to the unity that is above, right? And that's where he gets to in Gimel, over here on Parshas Vayeshev, Miketz Vayigash. He says, V'chol ma'alat Yisrael hu sheheim echad. The greatness, or Am Yisrael, achieves its greatness when it reaches the point of unity, right? That's why he says the mincha of Shabbos afternoon, when Am Yisrael reaches its greatest moment of unity, what does it say? Ata echad v'shimcha echad umi ka'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz, right? That's what it says there. The unity of God corresponds to the unity of the Jewish people. How does that relate to the Parsha? What is ultimately going on in the Parsha? In our Parsha, what do we have? We have Am Yisrael cutting off one of its limbs, an essential part of the limb, of essential part of its body. What is that limb? Yosef is sold out. And Yosef, what does he do? The sale of Yosef and the taking away of Yosef from the unity of Bnei Israel ultimately cuts into its power. That's why during all this time, what happens? Yaakov is unable to receive any prophecy after Yosef is gone. Why? Because there has been a blow to the unity of Am Yisrael. He compares Yosef's role within the Jewish people of the time to the role of the Sphira of Tiferet, which is the center of the Spherotic realm, the heart or the torso of the Spherotic realm. So Yosef, once he's taken out, it cuts out the direct relationship that exists between God and the Jewish people. The Spherotic realm is all out of whack because of that. That's why, when does it come? It comes Hanukkah time, when you have that sense of unification, the sense of the Jewish people being brought together. He also points out, he says Yaakov is one person, but he has, how many children? He has 12 children. So he says Yaakov is one, Aleph, and then he has 8 children from Leah's family, 4 children from Rachel's side. So Aleph, Chet, Dalet. You're rolling your eyes, but in Kabbalah, this is proof positive that what you are saying is correct. And he goes on to this to prove there that Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey actually has 12 different permutations that you can create the order of Shem Hashem. So therefore, 12 is 1, and 1 is 12, and they are all gathering together in that notion of beautiful oneness that we are seeking to create with our meditative spirit of mysticism. And it ends, I think, with one of the real his real kunzes. So he says, Rabbi Akiva. So does anyone know what was the name of Rabbi Akiva's father's name? He's known as Akiva ben Yosef. So says the Holy Shla. And what happened to Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva was one of the Asara Haruge Malchus, the 10 martyrs. The 10 martyrs who the Medrash tell us were killed. Why? Because of the sale of Yosef. And Rabbi Akiva, he says, is the Gilgal of Yosef. He is the return of Yosef, right? He has Yosef's neshama inside of him, says the Shla, Gevaldik. And what was Rabbi Akiva's last word that he said? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Parcha Nash Maso. His soul left him be'echad, with one. So he says Rabbi Akiva brought the notion of oneness back into. He understood the secret of what is all of what was missing. That ultimately the bringing of Echad. And he says that's why all the Rishonim. What do they say? Why? What was special about Hanukkah? It wasn't the Maccabees. It was Chana and her 7 children. That she. What did she do? She had the Mesiras Nefesh. She had the martyrdom of Rabbi Akiva that ultimately brought back that notion of oneness, because in the experience of martyrdom, that's when Am Yisrael finds its soul of oneness. Obviously, we would all prefer if there weren't any notion of martyrdom. But here you have this beautiful and very profound exposition on Kabbalah. Again, a lot of the themes of, you know, of classical Sephardic mysticism, Lurianic mysticism, certainly the Zohar mysticism, but also you can see the seeds of Kabbalah, the seeds of the notion of that one soul for all of Am Yisrael, and that sense. And you can see why it's written in a very comprehensible language. You can see why it becomes this powerful text for popularizing Kabbalah within Ashkenaz. So here you have, you know, again, not many people earn the name holy to be after your name. You know, some people add it to Rashi, but, you know, like I said, in the end of the day, there's only three guys who officially get it, you know, on their tombstones. You know, you have the Or HaChaim, you have the Ari, and you have here, again, one of the great, really influential Rabbanim of his generation, the Shlach HaKadosh, Rabbi Yishayahu ben Avraham Horowitz. Questions? What? Well, he wasn't the first Kabbalist, but the first Kabbalist was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So, all right.
In 1614, when they had the uprising and they kicked out the Jewish community, what did he do for 2 years?
So my hunch is he was independently wealthy. He probably found a place to himself a place to stay. What was he supposed to do? Live out in the fields?
I mean, go back
to Poland. Well, he might have gone back to Poland. It's unclear what he did. Yeah, like, you know, people didn't write biographies or autobiographies. The first one who's going to do that is Rav Yaakov Emden. So,
watch the History Channel.
Yeah, yeah. Do they have the Yishayahu Horowitz special? I don't know.
But, checks are better than the
All right, Shkayach.